Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of January 14th, 2016. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing today, D.R.?
Good. How are you doing?
Very well. Good, good, good. So, D.R., over the last few weeks, we have mentioned in passing several times a couple of legal cases that are floating around that relate to climate. A couple of them pertain here up in the Northeast. There's one out on the West Coast. I thought we should take a few minutes and discuss what has happened. Of course, there's been no ruling come down yet, but just what's at stake and why these things are of interest. So as backdrop, DR, you know that here in Massachusetts, we have a law that was passed in 2008 called the Global Warming Solutions Act. The Global Warming Solutions Act, and or the GWSA, as it that's its convenient acronym. Anyway, the long and short of that is that that bill called on the state to reduce emissions, and as the whole process worked out, we were called upon to reduce emissions by 25% by the year 2020, and by 80% by the year 2050, which are quite aggressive goals, sort of leaders in the country. And the rule also said, the law said that by 2013, it's now 3 years ago under former Governor Deval Patrick, the state was required to come out with a regulations in quotation marks, we'll say regulation in quotation marks, in order to achieve those goals. And so with that as backdrop, DR, tell me, the case that transpired here in Massachusetts in this past week that was heard, what was going on there?
Basically, there was a hearing on January the 8th in front of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court regarding that case, in which the plaintiffs argued that the state, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, has basically essentially ignored the enforcement of the Global Warming Solutions Act. And the state's defense is that basically, you know, the provisions laid out in the act are more projections, more timetables, more aspirations, but nothing hard and fast, and that therefore they are in fact, you know, going along with the act. So it'll be very, very interesting to see how that plays out and what the final ruling is.
Yeah, I think from what I've read, the Conservation Law Foundation, which is a group here in Boston, is making the case that the state of Massachusetts is required by the GWSA, required to put in enforceable regulations that mandate these kind of carbon reductions. And the state is arguing back, saying, oh, they're not mandated reductions. They're, as you said, aspirational. That's stuff we're trying to do. And the debate is about whether or not the Global Warming Solutions Act should be interpreted as being a mandate that forces things to happen, or something that is just something we hope to do. And I think that the court case surrounding that has another aspect. So let me say this: under the Global Warming Solutions Act, the state commits itself to doing things. And we can argue about whether or not we're required to do those things or we should just try to do those things. But in either case, the only enforcement mechanism, the only way you can force the state to do it, is through these legal suits where the court orders the state to do things, right? Because there's no penalty. You can't put the state of Massachusetts in jail for breaking its own law, right? The only way they're going to do this is through this court route. And it'll be an interesting... I think some of the questions that came back from the Supreme Judicial Justices seem to suggest they were listening favorably to the plaintiffs, that is to say, the good guys in the case. Right? Mm-hmm. They told the state, the Supreme Judicial Court told the state to go away and come back with justifications as to why the plans were going to work. Right? And if the state doesn't come back and say, yeah, here's how these plans are going to get us there, it seems to me the SJC could easily order that the state has a mandated responsibility. So it's a subtle difference, but it's a real difference, right?
It will be very interesting to see if the court orders that the state does more to counteract climate disorder. But obviously, as you might imagine, it is sort of frustrating from one perspective that sort of justice you cannot get from the executive branch or from the legislative branch. You have to go to the judicial branch. But on the other hand, you can make the argument that there's a long, long history in this country of that sort of thing happening.
Right. And so the reason that this is of interest, so the reason we're even talking about this court case in Dinky, Massachusetts, is, of course, that the law that Massachusetts has is a very aggressive and advanced law. But more importantly, we all know that the Paris Agreement came down in December, right? There's this global agreement that we have to move away from fossil fuels. The president is doing that. The United States is doing that through the Clean Power Plan, right? So we have this Clean Power Plan that we're going to do everything we promised in Paris. We're going to execute all those promises underneath the Clean Power Plan. But the Clean Power Plan goes down another level to where the states have to execute the Clean Power Plan. Right, we've talked about this at some length, right, that each state has to propose its own plan to satisfy the federal government about how it's going to reduce, each state is going to reduce its own emissions. Right? So all of a sudden you say, well, the things that are going to satisfy the Paris Accord, which are noble and we all want to see done, primarily are going to happen in the states. And so having these state laws pass and be successful and say be a precedent to a different state, for Massachusetts to be a precedent to a different state, is really important, right? So that's why this court case here in Massachusetts is of some consequence, I think.
Definitely, definitely. It could truly be a game changer, and could truly follow the same path that the marriage equality cases followed from Massachusetts to other parts of the country, all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Now, one of the things that we've talked about in the past is something called the public trust doctrine. And the public trust doctrine is this idea that basically it stems out of taking care of common waterways from 300 or 400 years ago. You know, everyone had to take care of the pond. The pond was the public trust because that's what everybody drank out of, right? There's this public trust doctrine that floats around, and some lawyers are trying to use that as a justification for the courts, right, to order the executive branch to take climate action. To do something, right? They say that the government has a responsibility. The government carries the public's trust in taking care of these common resources. And I was just saying, you and I were talking before, DR, that the in the specific court case here in Massachusetts, it seems to me the Conservation Law Foundation has not highlighted the public trust doctrine because it's a little bit tenuous, I think. I mean, you have to kind of stretch it to make it fit. The CLF has more focused on the failure of the state government, either in the form of the Patrick administration or now the Baker administration, the failure of the state government to implement its own laws. And that's what they're asking for. I think that's probably stronger ground. Would you agree?
Exactly. It appears that the thinking is that, the Global Warming Solutions Act was in its own way a manifestation of the atmospheric trust doctrine, and that's sort of the legal terrain they seem to be walking on, and basically saying that, you have to live up to your own laws, and if a state does not live up to its own laws, the state is doing something profoundly wrong.
Right. So the idea that the here in Massachusetts, we as climate hawks hope that the Supreme Judicial Court, the highest court in Massachusetts, orders the executive branch to mandate, send out regulations to address the emissions reductions here in Massachusetts. That all gets tied up in a whole other idea about utilities, right? So here in Massachusetts, there's an interesting article in Commonwealth Magazine talking about the utilities as being an obstacle to the implementation of these cleaner energies, and the name of the article is "The Power Behind the Plug," and basically makes the case that the utilities are still have a disincentive to try to reduce electricity usage, and that they make all their money, the utilities make their money by building pipelines and power lines. And that's why they want the Northeast Direct Pipeline and all that kind of stuff. But one of the interesting things, let me see if I can find it here, one of the interesting concepts is this what's called the utility death spiral. Mm-hmm. Okay, and what happens in the point, one of the people in the article was saying this is what the utilities are afraid of, that they don't want to go into this death spiral, where what they see solar power on people's homes as a threat, because as people use more and more local electricity, more and more of their own electricity, the utility gets to raise the rates on everybody so they stay whole. The state has promised them that. But that means that prices go up for everybody and more people build solar power, right? Yes. So then they have to raise the prices again and more people build solar power. And you get to the point where the existing system forces everyone to build solar power and the utilities go out of business, which mm-hmm. I don't think would be the worst thing in the world, but that's just me. So
the piece really did seem to heavily emphasize the idea that these utilities are fairly obviously seeking to sort of strangle the solar market in a way similar to what we've seen in other parts of the country. I think we recently mentioned the matter in Nevada where basically a big utility, if you will, successfully chased Solar City out of Nevada and caused 500 people to lose their jobs. And it does seem to be the case that the utilities prefer to have dirty energy as their ever source, if you will, and would like to see solar be sunset, if you will.
You've got so many metaphors in there, DR. I admire you. So there's that. That's in Massachusetts. The other topic we'd like to jump over and discuss is happening out on the West Coast in the state of Washington, D.C. So sometime in late 2014, September of 2014, a group of people, five people, effectively chained themselves to the railroad tracks in front of an oil train. Okay, mm-hmm. And they stopped the oil train. This is very, very reminiscent of a case here in Massachusetts where a couple of guys got into a lobster boat and they sailed in front of a coal barge that was trying to deliver coal to the Brayton Point power plant down in Fall River. Mm-hmm. Anyway, these people out in the state of Washington effectively chained themselves to the railroad track, big trains coming along, a big arrest scene ensues, and they're all taken away.
Sure.
Those people then claim what's called the necessity defense, right, DR?
Mm-hmm.
And I can explain the necessity defense. Do you want to say, you know, what those people were claiming in court as being, the devil made me do it kind of thing?
Essentially, the necessity defense is built around the idea that there's a sort of higher principle that justifies the technical breaking of a law. It's essentially boiled down to its very essence, and it is civil disobedience. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, you know, probably one of the earliest examples, maybe not the earliest, but one of the most famous examples of necessity defense, if from a certain perspective, is what Rosa Parks did. You know, she broke a law because it was necessary to say that segregation is wrong, mm-hmm. and moving somebody to the back of the bus because the color of their skin is wrong. So you can say that she was the patron saint of the necessity defense in many ways.
And so we put up a podcast, I think it was last March or so, DR, where we went through some of the details of the sort of the legalistic details of what makes a necessity defense. And for example, one of the things that if you say it was necessary for me to break this law, you have to explain how all the other mechanisms of getting the good thing you want couldn't do, right? You had to lay on the railroad tracks. There was nothing else that you could possibly do.
Mm-hmm.
So, very interesting stuff. It turns out that out in the state of Washington, finally, after being sort of turned down here in Massachusetts, turned down for Tim DeChristopher, who was also a famous, shall we say, civil disobedience guy, these mm-hmm. folk, the judge out in Washington finally let the group of people who tied themselves to the railroad track, who are known as the Delta Five, mm-hmm. they got to use the necessity defense. The judge allowed them to do that, right?
Initially, the judge did, but then it was later reported that the judge instructed the jury not to consider the necessity of defense. It's very it's sort of strange and not terribly clear why the judge all of a sudden reversed and said the necessity of defense was not allowed. But it just seems to be a sort of odd turn of events. Now, obviously, just because you tell a jury not to consider the necessity of defense doesn't mean that they will not on some level consider it. They may find other grounds to move for an acquittal. But it just seems very strange that the judge who initially allowed the necessity of defense all of a sudden essentially reversed himself and said, no, do not consider the necessity of defense.
Right. And that's something we've only heard in the last few hours. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think that the interesting point, though, is one you just alluded to, DR, is that by initially allowing the necessity defense, if you say that, then the defendants, the Delta 5 people who were on the railroad tracks, were allowed to bring in scientists and all kinds of people to explain exactly what global warming, mm-hmm. What the issues are, why it was necessary, and the exactly. political, so they got to have a fairly several days of detailed testimony about climate change entered into the record. And that's exactly. one of the, even if they didn't get to use the necessity defense as their reason for being acquitted, mm-hmm. right, they still got to make the case in court, which I think mm-hmm. is a big breakthrough, right?
Yeah.
And to your point, maybe the jurors heard it, and, even if they're told not to think about it, it's kind of hard not to think of an elephant after someone said the word, right?
Isn't it amazing, though, that, the Delta 5, these people are being prosecuted, but the people who drive the bomb trains, they don't ever seem to be prosecuted, mm-hmm. do they? When's the last time you've heard of a prosecution of somebody driving one of those trains that explodes and kills people? Never seems to happen.
It doesn't seem to happen. No, it's just a terrible accident. All right, well, DR, we got to leave it there. Our legal, I have completely exhausted my legal knowledge with the meager stuff we've talked about tonight. So we got to stop. But we'll put up links to at least most of what we talked about tonight at the blog. It's massclimateaction.net/blog. Please visit us. Please donate to MCAN when you're there. You can find us on Facebook at @massclimateaction. Again, please share us, like us, so other people can find out about us. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher or iTunes. You can, or TuneIn Radio. So we'll close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. So thank you very much for being here, DR.
Thanks.
And thanks to everyone for listening. We really appreciate it. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.